Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ Triggering. Today's presenter is Beverly Brown. Beverly has been in WebSphere MQ L2 support since 1997 after 10 years in KIC support. She primarily supports MQ on the COS and VSE platforms, but has also supported MQ on distributed platforms. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Beverly.
Hello, and as Joseph said, I'm Beverly Brown, and I'd also like to welcome you to this presentation about WebSphere MQ triggering. If we could go to slide 2, please. What we'll be talking about is what is triggering and how does it work? How does the flow of this process work? What are the different types of triggering and how do you set it up? What are the conditions for a trigger event, and some tips to diagnose some triggering problems. We'll just have some miscellaneous helpful notes and then a link to some triggering documentation and the support pack page. So this information will be basic to intermediate, and I will actually make the assumption that you know what queues and channels are. So if we go to the next slide, please. I would like to give special recognition to Calista Stevens. While I'm the one that will be doing the speaking today, Calista made a significant contribution to the content of this presentation, and those of you that work with the iSeries platform will be very familiar with her. And if we go to the next slide, please. So, just to begin with, what is triggering? And it is a function that will allow you to automatically start an application or channel when messages have been put to a queue and a certain set of conditions have been satisfied. Slide 5, please. So how does it work? First of all, we have a message that gets put to a queue that has been configured for triggering. And if the series of conditions are met, and we will discuss those later, the queue manager will send a special internal trigger message to an initiation queue. And when this happens, it's called a trigger event. And I'd like to point out that the application will not be putting to or getting from this initiation queue. That initiation queue is just for the communication of this trigger event. It's actually a trigger monitor program that will monitor that initiation queue and read the trigger message when it arrives and then take some action based on the contents of the message. For instance, it might contain the name of the channel to start or the name of a program to start and possibly some information to be passed on to the program. Now, the trigger monitors may be built in. There are a few. For instance, for channels, the channel initiator is the trigger monitor. On ZOS, that's the chin job, or for distributed, that's the run in QCHI process. For applications, there's a built-in trigger monitor called RunMQTRM for applications. And there is actually, for Unix and Windows platforms, a RunMQTMC trigger monitor that can be used on clients. ZOS has built-in KIX and IMS trigger monitors. Some other trigger monitors might be supplied by a support pack. And these start with M as in Mary, A as in Apple, and Apple meaning application. Just a few of them include MA12, and that is for ZOS, the batch trigger monitor. There's not actually a built-in trigger monitor to start batch jobs, but the support pack will give you that function. There's MA10, and that's the letter O, that is an example of a Rex trigger monitor. MA6L, has an L as in Larry, is an AIX trigger for a Lotus Notes agent. You could actually trigger that off. And again, there's a link at the end of the presentation to the Support Pack webpage. You actually also could write your own trigger monitor. Go on to slide 6. And this is basically another way to look at what we just talked about, especially for those of you who are more visually oriented. So let's just go back through this again. Number one, we have a message that's put to a queue by an application, or it even could be coming by way of an MCA channel. And that message will be put to the queue manager, to just a regular local queue or a transmit queue. Number two, if the conditions are met, a trigger message will be put on an initiation queue. Number three, the trigger monitor program will retrieve the message from the initiation queue. And number four, it will start the user program or the channel that takes us over to the box on the right-hand side, where number five, the message will be retrieved from the initial local or transmission queue by the application or the channel. So you'll notice that the application just deals with that local queue. It does not deal with the initiation queue. Slide 7, please. There are three trigger types, and this is something that's part of the definition of the queue that is being set up for triggering. One of the types is first, and that means when a message is put to the queue and the depth of the queue changes from 0 to 1, then a trigger event could occur, provided the other conditions are met. When you do this, your serving program that started should process all the messages on the queue. For instance, read to no messages are available, and then it might end then, or it might just continue running. For instance, a channel would do that. Once a channel is started, it'll stay started unless you have a disconnect interval set up. Trigger every is literal. Every time a message is put on the trigger queue, and a trigger event could occur. And you might use this when the serving program will only process one message at a time. Slide 8, please. Another type, the last type, is depth. And that means that when the depth of the queue reaches a certain amount as specified by a trig depth attribute, then the trigger event will occur if the conditions are met. Something unique about this type is that the queue manager will actually disable triggering for the queue and expect the application that started to go ahead and handle all those messages. After that, there must be a manual re-enabling of the trigger. And that could be done by an alter of the queue, or more likely it would be done programmatically with an MQ set to set that trigger attribute back on. Slide 9, please. Something that is unique for trigger type first is that there is something called a trigger interval, a trigint. This is an attribute of the queue manager definition, and it's a time interval in milliseconds. And what this is, it's kind of a safety net for trigger type first. Imagine that you have an application that's triggered, but something happens and it abends before all the messages are read. So now the next time a message is put, well, the depth is not going from 0 to 1 anymore. So a new trigger event won't occur. And you could just end up with messages building up indefinitely. So to help out with this, the code will actually look and say, all right, if it's been that interval time since the last trigger message was created for the queue, I'll go ahead and create one. And that's kind of a stopgap so that it doesn't indefinitely go on. Now, be aware that the default value is 9 nines, and that works out to about 11 and a half days. So that's not really going to do you much good. So you would actually want to go in and set this value to something more reasonable depending on your environment. Just as an example, 5 nines or 99999 is about 1.6 minutes. And you could figure out however from there you would like to set it. Now, ZOS has something additional that came along in version 6 that's called backstop triggering. And that's actually where there's a process that will go out and run approximately every trigger interval time and look for queues that might have messages that are built up. They're trigger first and there's a depth. So it will actually kick off a trigger event rather than waiting until the next time a message is put to that queue. And that can help if your queue is one that has a low volume of messages. Normally that is useful, but if that actually causes you some problems, there is a service parameter that could be set to stop those extra backstop trigger messages. The service parameter is provided via an APAR, PK39103. Again, that's P as in Peter, K as in King, 39103, and you would need to contact the support center to get the instructions on how to use that if you have need to use that. On to slide 10, please. So now we'll go ahead to channel triggering setup. First, you have an initiation queue, and you can use the default system.channel.init queue. Or for non-ZOS platforms, you can actually create a different initiation queue. We will actually tell the channel name, the name of the channel, to be started either in trigger data that's on the queue definition, or it could be specified in a process definition. For some platforms, that process definition is actually required, but it's optional on some of the platforms such as AIX, HP, Linux, i5OS, Solaris, Windows, and ZOS. And it's simpler to just use the trigger data than the process definition. And you will either create or alter an existing transmission queue to tie it together with this initiation queue and possibly process definition. So if we go on to slide 11, we'll have just this, an example of the simplest setup. Here, we are not using the process definition. We have a queue local called QM2, and that is a transmit queue. And we're turning on triggering with the trigger attribute. The alternative to that is no trigger, so we want to be sure that trigger is on. And trig type first is what you'll normally use for a channel. And then here we have the trig data that has the channel name, and then the init queue, the default of system.channel.init queue. So here in our queue definition, we're tying together the init queue and the channel name. On to slide 12, please. I went ahead and included examples if you are using a process definition, just to have this here. This is one for a distributed platform, and your transmit queue definition is basically the same, except instead of trig data, you'll have a process parameter with the name of the process. Then you'll have a separate definition for that process, and where you specify the channel name in this case is in the user data of that process. On to slide 13. Here's an example on ZOS. It has a couple of differences or additions in the process definition. First, you'll notice that there's an Apple type of MVS. Each of the platforms has a default Apple type, and that comes from the default local key definition. Because of the history of MQ and how it was when it first was created, on ZOS, it started out as KIX transactions, so the default was KIX as the Apple type. So we need to say here that it's MVS. And then we also need to give some special information in the Applic ID, and that is CSQX start. And that is a special indication to the queue manager that this process is to start a channel. Now, if you are putting this in the CSQRX panels, you don't need the quotes around the CSQX start. But as you can see, it's easier just to use the trigger data. So, but I wanted to show this because it is a little different if you go that route. On slide 14, I also have an example of the i5OS since it has different administration commands, but it's all the same concept as what we've been talking about. On slide 15, we'll move on to application triggering. So again, we'll have an initiation queue, which you can define yourself, where you can use the default system.default.initiation.queue. And in this case, you must create a process definition. That's the only way to tell the trigger monitor what application to start. And then you'll either create or alter an existing local or queue model. Queue aliases and queue remotes don't have trigger attributes, but the actual queue locals or queue models do. And we'll have to tie all these objects together with the definitions. So on slide 16, let me tell you a little bit more about the process definition and a few more of the parameters. One of those is the Applic ID, and that's going to be the name of your application that you want to start. And just have a couple of examples here for Unix and Windows where you can see the path and the executable. There were already examples on ZOS and iSeries. There is a parameter called invert data that can be used to send some environment data. And one of the things you can do with that on the Unix system is set up to ampersand, and that will make the started application run in the background rather than under that trigger monitor process. The application can be passed a parameter list via a structure called an MQTMC2, and that would contain user data that's defined in this process and or the invert data that's defined here. On the distributed flat platforms, there is actually a triggering sample, and that would show you some of the basic use of that MQTMC2 structure passing data to the application. So on slide 17, I have an example of the application triggering setup. First here, we're defining an init queue called IQ and defining a process. In this case, the apple type is Kix, and the applic ID is payr, that's your transaction name. And in this example, there's some user data that would be passed to the application. So then in the QLocal definition for Q1, we're tying that all together by specifying the name of the init queue and the process, and then we're saying we want to turn on triggering, and in this case, use trigger type first. If you were using trig type depth, then there would also be an additional parameter of trig depth. The Web3MQ system administration guide has other examples for distributed platforms. And on slide 18, there is an example there for the i5 OS. But again, the application programming guide for applications and the intercommunication guide for channels does have sample definitions. So now if we move on to slide 19, please. These are the trigger conditions that I've made reference to. Now, the details for this are in the application programming guide under a section called Conditions for a Triggering Event. And this is if you're going to be working with triggering, this is a good section to review, and you might have to review it a few times for all the information to sink in, but I'll just have the basics here, just sort of the one-liners of the concepts for these various conditions that are checked in the code. So number one is, just to begin with, a message is put to a transmission or local queue, and that's what's going to start this whole processing off. Number two, the message's priority is greater than or equal to the trigger message priority of the queue. And most people are just going to use the default priority and everything's going to be the same, but be aware that you can do some things with the priority there. On slide 20, number three, this is where for the various trigger types it's making a check. For example, for trigger type first, it's making sure that the depth is going from 0 to 1, or for type depth that it's going from trigger depth minus 1 up to trigger depth, or for every, it's any number. The depth doesn't matter there. And for shared queues, it will only count committed messages, and that's, I'm talking about on ZOS queues that exist in the coupling facility. But in all other cases, for everybody else, it could count committed and uncommitted messages. On condition 4, if it's trigger type first or depth, the code will make sure that no program already has that triggered application queue open for gets. In other words, its open input count or IP props is 0. The expectation is that for those types that the queue will be read until it's empty, so it would just be a waste of resource to actually try to start the another copy of the application. Number 5, we're going to make sure that the queue is get enabled, the trigger queue is get enabled. Slide 21, please. Need to make sure that a process name is specified in the definition and that process exists. Or in the case of a transmission queue, if there's not a process name, it'll make sure that the trigger data contains the name of a channel. 7, need to make sure that an initiation queue has been specified and that it exists and that it is enabled for puts and gets. 8, we're going to be sure that a trigger monitor has been started and has the initiation queue open for gets. Now, be aware that this means you can't, as a problem determination option, you can't stop the trigger monitor and then look to see if a trigger message is created, because if the trigger monitor isn't active, because of this condition, that trigger message will not be put on the initiation queue. Slide 22. Number 9, we're just going to make sure that trigger is turned off, on, and that it's not no trigger, and that the trigger type is not set to none, that it's first, every, or death. And then number 11, this goes back to our trigger interval we were talking about. If trigger type is first, it will check that trigger interval to see if that time has elapsed since the last trigger message was created for that queue. And then condition 12, this is one of my favorites because it's something that comes up quite a bit in problem determination. Here's a case where at close time of the queue, if that's the only application that was serving the queue, it issues an MQ close, and then there are still messages on the queue that satisfy certain of the other conditions, another trigger event will be created. And in a way, that's goodness. That will make sure that your messages don't build up. Even for trigger type first, this will prevent you from having to fall into that trigger interval processing. But also be aware that this can cause a loop. Say, for instance, your application looks at a message, backs it out, and then closes the queue. Well, during close processing, the code will look and say, oh, there's still a depth on this queue, so we're going to create another trigger message. Trigger happens, application gets started, it gets that message, looks at it, still doesn't like it, backs it out. So you can end up with a loop in this case. So if you have backout processing that occurred, you want to be sure and check the backout count to prevent just an endless loop. And we'll mention this condition 12 again later on. On slide 23, condition 13, there are certain actions that may happen that could also cause trigger events. For instance, if the application or transmit queue is changed from no trigger to trigger, that will cause a trigger event. Even if the type is first and there's a depth, it will go ahead and do it because of this action. Or it's changed from put or get disabled to enabled. Or if a trigger monitor opens the initiation queue, it'll go ahead and check certain conditions that are listed in the manual, but it's not going to hold you up on trigger type first when your monitor starts. And then number 14, this is a little more advanced. It's talking about message delivery sequence and relative to the priority of messages and trigger message priority and that sort of thing. All right, so if we go on to slide 24, problem determination. So first thing to think about in your thought process is this a brand new configuration? If so, and you're having a problem, there's a good chance there is a configuration problem, or maybe the configuration changed, and that might have caused the problem. Or if the setup is new and has worked before, just go back through those conditions and make sure they're all satisfied. Again, you can go back to this pitch or in the application programming guide where they're listed and just think about those conditions and make sure they're all satisfied. Be aware if you're triggering a channel, that triggering will not work if the channel is in a stopped state. If it's literally stopped, you're going to have to do a manual start of the channel to enable the triggering to work. The stop channel disables triggering and gets on the transmission queue, and it just won't go anywhere. So make sure that the channel isn't stopped literally. On slide 25, some other things to think about. If this is application triggering, make sure your application name is correct, and that's part of that validating the configuration. Or maybe the application does get called, but make sure it's coded correctly and actually retrieves messages as you expect. Or make sure the correct authorizations are in place to access the queue and so on. You need to be sure a trigger message can be delivered. Maybe the initiation queue is disabled or something like that. Or you might need to check the dead letter queue, see if something has gone there. You need to make sure your trigger monitor is active. You need to make sure that your trigger type and application design match. For instance, if you're going with trigger type first or depth, you want to be sure to have a loop of gets. You don't just want to get one message and then go, leave. You might get stranded. Now, because of condition 12, you might be okay in this with trigger type first, but it's just going to be a lot less efficient. It's better if you just go ahead and read all the messages. Something else you can do is to make sure that the triggered application is working, just try manually starting it and to see if it's able to run. And be aware you might have some parameters that need to be passed to it, but that's a good test just to make sure the problem isn't on that side. And all of these points feed into one of the basics of triggering problem determination. There are a couple of places where things can go wrong. One is maybe the trigger event doesn't even happen because the conditions of triggering weren't met. So there's never a trigger message put to the initiation queue. Or it could be that all of that works. The trigger monitor gets the message from the init queue, but then the problem is either with starting the application or it actually starts but just doesn't do what's expected. So you just really have to determine which side of the fence that the problem is on, and it may require a trace to check that. But before getting a trace, you certainly want to just double-check yourself on the configuration and the conditions. On slide 26, please. One of the common problems I see is that the messages are stranded, that triggering, it doesn't seem to be working. So if we're working with trigger type first, again, the first thing I think of is making sure that your application is getting more than one message and that you may need to use trigger interval as a safety net, because the triggering is going to only occur when the depth goes from 0 to 1 or if the queue is being closed and there's still a depth. Now, something that you have to really think about with trigger type every, if that application is only getting one message, let's say you put 5 messages. So there are 5 applications that are kicked off, and 4 of the messages are gotten, but for some reason, in the case of the 5th, the application abends, and that 5th message isn't gotten. So it's sitting there. Next time a message comes along, it's trigger every, so provided the other conditions are met, a trigger event will occur, the application will run, it'll get a message. Which message is it going to get? Most likely it's just reading the oldest message. So it's going to get message number 5. If it's only reading one message, it's going to go away and leave number 6. So you get kind of out of sync, and you're always running behind. So just be aware of that. You may have to manually kick off your triggered application just to catch it up, or you might design the application so that the messages can expire. And that way, if they start growing too old, then they'll expire, and you can eventually get caught up. You might use a monitor to see if it looks like the messages are building up. But just that's something to really think about and be careful with trigger type every. On slide 27, another common issue we tend to see is somebody reports, oh, there's a loop of triggering or there's high CPU. And one of the first things I'll think about here is our condition 12. See, it's my favorite. It's advised in the application programming guide that you use the wait interval on the MQ get. And that way, there can be a little bit of time. Say if a message isn't yet committed, there could be a little bit of time, and that way you'll prevent this loop that we're talking about. Even if there's not a back out involved. Earlier I was talking about a back out scenario, but in this case, maybe the message isn't committed. The application does the get. It gets the return code 2033, closes the queue, goes away. Well, there's still a debt. So condition 12 is going to say, well, I'm going to kick off another trigger. And as you can see, if that MQ get doesn't involve some sort of wait interval, you can start cranking through pretty fast just doing a loop of triggering that's not really doing anything. And it drives up your CPU. And if it's kicks, it would drive up your transaction and program use counts. So it's just really advisable to do that, use that wait option, because there are scenarios where you can get in a situation where the message may not be triggered yet. Technically, a trigger message is part of the unit of work. So your first time through, you're not likely to hit that scenario, but especially if you have multiple putters and things like that going on, and especially with a channel, you could end up with uncommitted messages causing trigger events, so just be careful with that. We have our support webpage. I have a link there. And one of the good things you might want to search for is a keyword called must gather. That's all one word, must gather and triggering. And that will take you to various tech notes for the different platforms that will talk about the kind of documentation you may need to gather or a few hints. If you just search for triggering in general, you will get a lot of hits, but there could be a lot of information out there. You'll also find this pitch now once it's out there and have it as a reference. And in the end, you just may need to run a trace. If you've just gone through all these conditions and configuration and still can't see what's going on, you just may have to run a trace to see whether the problem is that a trigger message isn't being created in the first place, or if it is, then something is happening afterwards. So how you would do that would certainly be platform dependent. All right, slide 28, please. Just some various notes. For trigger type every, if the trigger monitor were to end prematurely, or say it's just starting up, no matter how many messages are on the queue, only one trigger message will be created on restart. So that's another thing to think about for trigger every. It's not going to, when the trigger monitor starts, it's not going to do a new event for the count of the cur depth. It's just going to do one. On the distributed platforms, the trigger monitor RunMQ TRM will not get another trigger message until the application completes. So there are a couple things you can do about that. One is you could run multiple trigger monitors, or you could run applications in the background. And remember I said that you could, in the Enver data, you could use the ampersand on Unix to cause it to run in the background. On slide 29, you might need to check the dead letter queue and make sure that there are no messages, either application messages or trigger messages, going to the dead letter queue. Some examples of things that might cause that to happen would be that the queue manager couldn't put a trigger message on the init queue, say it's full. Or you have to try to do this, but the trigger message is too large for the initiation queue. But as a default, that wouldn't be a concern. You would have to really change the max message length on the init queue for that to happen. Maybe there's an error in the trigger message structure, or there's an unsupported application type, or for any of the platforms that it can't start the application, and or maybe there's a data conversion error. So you would just have to look at the dead letter message and see what the reason was that it was put there. Slide 30, please. Trigger messages that are put to the initiation queue are non-persistent, so they won't survive the restart. But certainly across the restart, as your trigger monitor starts, as I mentioned before, if the conditions are met, the trigger event will occur. The trigger messages take on the default priority of the init queue. And most people are going to just use the default priority and won't mess with those priorities, but it can be done. I made reference to this before. The trigger monitors don't retrieve the initiation messages that are part of the unit of work until the unit of work completes. So, for instance, if, even on a channel, say you have a batch and persistent messages, the trigger message will be created, but it won't be committed until that batch is committed. So first time through, you're good. But again, just be aware there are situations where you could end up with the uncommitted messages causing the count to go up and a trigger event to occur, but the messages aren't committed yet. On slide 31, I believe I mentioned this before, the queue manager counts both committed and uncommitted messages on the trigger queue. There have been requirements submitted about that, but that is not a function that has been changed yet. I believe that really they're the whole what people are used to are quite dependent on that, or it would be a large change. So that's how it is. Just be aware of that. Now, the exception to that is on ZOS, if you have a shared queue that's on a coupling facility, with the way the triggering works with that and the way it saves information about the shared queues and communicates, it will only trigger for committed messages. And you could have a shared triggered queue. You can also have a shared initiation queue that's monitored by multiple monitors on different queue managers. So after recycling the queue manager or trigger monitor, a trigger message may be created. I've already touched on that before. And on to slide 32. For triggering channels, trigger type of first or depth is recommended. It just generally would not make sense to do trigger every for a channel. You would just be wasting processing that wouldn't really buy you anything. Now, if you disable triggering, that action is not under sync point control. So say you're working with triggering of trigger type depth. If the program backs out the unit of work or it admins, the messages would be backed out, but it's not going to back out the fact that the triggering was disabled. You still will have to go and do an NQ set or an alter to re-enable triggering for depth. On ZOS, the KIX trigger monitor automatically reconnects after the queue manager terminates and restarts. So that helps you out there where you won't have to have that manual intervention. And if we go on to slide 33, this is where I made reference to some links to the documentation. First, for the channel triggering, I have a link to the intercommunication guide. And for application triggering, I have a link to the application programming guide. And those are both going to be good references for you to go back to if you're just starting to work with triggering or if you're working with a problem. And then on the third bullet, I just have a link to the manuals in general. If you go to that library section, you can find the information center where you can do searches, or you can find the individual books in PDF format where you can just bring them up in Adobe, or you could even print them if you want to. And then here's the promised link to the support pack webpage. If you go there, then you'll be able to do a find on some of those support pack numbers I mentioned, or just do a find for trigger, or just scan through and see there are quite a few good support packs out there for your disposal. And then to slide 34. So just as a summary, we've talked about what triggering is, that it will allow you to automatically start an application or a channel when a message arrives, and that way you don't have to have your program or your channel just sitting there using up resources when it's not going to be doing anything. So that's actually one of the good ways to start a channel at startup. You could either start a channel by having a start command in your script, or you can trigger the start of the channel. We talked about some examples of how to set up triggering in both instances, the conditions for a trigger event, and some of the problem determination, and the thought process to go through, and some of the common problems we see here in the support center. And on to slide 35. Here we have a chart that includes some links to a number of sites that will provide some valuable online resources for the WebSphere products. For instance, DeveloperWorks has some in-depth technical information. The events link on the support pages, that will point you to webcasts and other conference information. You can go to WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of some self-help modules to help get new users going more quickly. And then there's the ESR tool, or just recently the new tool was called SR. That's for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And then there's the My Support link on all product support pages that will let you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. So, Joseph, I'll hand back over to you now.
Thank you, Beverly, for a great presentation. At this point, Dahlia, we would like to open the line for questions.
Ran Saha with IBM has our question.
Yeah, actually, I have a question regarding the trigger type every. And this is basically related to one of the typical issues that we are facing in our application. Like, you are suggesting that for trigger type every, the application is supposed to handle only one message at a time. But what happens when there are messages accumulated in the queue for which the trigger did not get generated, and next time when a trigger gets generated, it reads only one of the message, and still we have a backlog in the queue. So what is the issue if we design the application to read all the messages in the queue when we use trigger type AC? Is there any problem with that?
Okay, thank you. That is one of the tricky things about trigger type every, and it actually could be good for it to go ahead and read the additional messages that are there. The main drawback would just be that you would still have trigger events for every message that was put, and so you might have additional instances of your application start, but if the messages have already been read, they would just check the queue, realize there are no messages, and go away. So there's a little bit of overhead, but that may be worth it to you to be sure you don't get behind by only reading one message.
Okay, so if we can handle that, like, no message in the queue kind of error inside the application properly, can we basically have that kind of a design where with every trigger type, every, we allow the application to read through all the messages in the queue?
Sure, yeah. There's nothing in the checking of the code that would cause a problem for. Or another alternative is to get your message and then do at least one more get with a wait, but maybe your option of doing a loop is better because if there's more than one, it could take you longer to catch up.
Yeah, that is what we are facing actually in one of the applications.
Mm-hmm.
So we are just trying to plan to change our design this way, so I just wanted to find out if there is any drawback with that or not.
Yeah, just the additional triggering. And actually, it might help if you do have a larger volume. That would mean you would have more applications that could potentially get the messages, so you could have more than one processing it, but then you still don't end up with stranded messages. So it sounds like for your situation, that would be the best way to go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And now from Cummings, we have Adu Algapan.
Yeah. Hi. I have a question regarding the, when we want to trigger an IMS transaction, what is the process application type or the application ID that we need to specify?
So there would actually be an Apple type of IMS, and the syntax of the applic ID, I would refer you to, I believe it's the system setup guide. There is actually a section in there that talks about the IMS triggering and how you set it up.
What is the trigger monitoring for the, like, run MQTRM? We use it for the Windows, right? So likewise, what is there for the IMS side that we can initiate, like, can start for the triggering?
It's part of the queue manager on ZOS.
Okay.
So you don't have to actually start anything else separately.
Okay. And one more question is, like, when we wanted to trigger a Java program, like which is a jar file, is it possible from the trigger monitoring that we can trigger those jar files, or is it only the exe file that we can trigger?
You could trigger a jar file as well.
Okay. And similarly, the COBOL programming, we can trigger the program, COBOL program?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next in our queue, we have Barbara Hale with Conway.
Hi, yes. We're using a distributed side, and our basic use of triggering is for channels.
Yes.
And I was wondering, is there a recommended trigger interval that we should be using if we're triggering basically only channels?
It's really not as likely to be as critical there. You certainly wouldn't want it as low as a minute or anything like that. You just have to decide, if you had to call back on that safety net, what would be the longest time you'd want to wait? Is it 5 minutes? Is it 30 minutes? Because usually, assuming your channel starts, even if it disconnects, then the triggering would happen the next time, or if the channel fails, then your channel retry processing is going to go in and try to restart that channel. So you would just have to decide how long, if by some chance, I really haven't seen that scenario too much, but just to be safe, how long would you be willing to wait for that safety net?
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Next in our queue, we have Brent Morris with HP.
Hello?
Yes, I was just wondering, on slide 32, the last bullet, based upon your comments, is where it states, after the queue manager terminates, should that be after the queue manager recycles? Or that?
Yeah, right, after it, if the queue manager terminates and then restarts, right.
Okay.
Information or processing in the KIX adapter would actually sit out there and watch for that to come back, watch for the queue manager to restart, so then it would do the reconnect of that CKTI trigger monitor.
Okay. Thank you for the point of clarification. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
This is just a wonderful web session. So, thank you so much.
Glad to hear it.
And next with Northern Territory Group, we have Van Thompson.
Yeah, hi. I have a question in regard to trigger monitors. With the sample programs on ZOS, each trigger monitor is a started task. Is the only way to sort of limit and build like basically the solution to having less started tasks to build your own trigger monitor that can monitor many queues, is that the solution, or just having lots and lots of started tasks out there? Is that the only way of having it, sort of thing? Is it?
Yeah, because I believe that it just lets you specify one initiation queue.
Yeah, it's a one-to-one relationship. And coming from a SysProc perspective, we don't like lots and lots of started tasks.
Right. In that case, you might need to take the batch. I assume you're talking batch.
Yes, batch.
Yeah, take that, and I believe the support pack has the source with it where you could go and actually modify it.
Okay, all right. I'll have to go have a look at that. And a great presentation. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And Mr. Lamb and Ms. Brown, we have no further questions in our queue. Back to you, Mr. Lamb, for closing remarks.
Thank you, Dahlia. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.